At this time in the millennium, we will have experienced something that mankind has never experienced before, something totally unheard of in today's world, something that has eluded mankind since the beginning of time. At this time in the millennium, we will have experienced over 850 years of peace. The world has never really experienced peace. From the very beginning, our history started with Cain killing his brother Abel. Let's turn over to Genesis 4, verse 6. Genesis 4, verse 6 says, "So the Lord said to Cain, 'Why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it.' Now Cain talked with his brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him." So a solution was born. If you don't like somebody, if somebody gets in your way, you kill them. You disagree with them. Even Cain was afraid that someone was going to find him and kill him. It had become a way of life all of a sudden. The solution to the problems is that you would go to war to settle differences. Families went to war with families, clans went to war with clans, and today nations go to war with nations. That's continued to be the history of man from that time forward. In fact, human history at its core is the story of wars. It's estimated that in the 20th century, over 108 million people have died in wars. Sometimes we hear numbers like that and it just kind of glazes over. You don't think that much about it. 108 million people. It's 108 million individuals that God said was so valuable that he sent his son to die for them. And they were all killed in wars. We've had a war so destructive, so unbelievably horrible, that it was nicknamed the war to end all wars. Because surely after that, when no one would ever want to go to war again. That was World War I. World War II followed just 21 years later. Mankind did not learn the lessons that we had hoped that they would learn from that war. We've tried to end wars. We've had organizations like the League of Nations, NATO, and the United Nations. Even so, the world remains at war. Do you even realize that the United States right now is at war? We've been blessed. We've got such wide borders with our oceans. Where we're positioned on the globe has removed us so far from the battles that we're in. But that has not stopped us from being in war. According to the latest White House report on war, the United States is involved in 7 ongoing wars right now. Yet we just go on about our lives, we don't even realize it sometimes. The United States, in her 242 years as a nation, has been at war 92% of that time. All the time that we've been a nation, we have only experienced about 20 years of peace. Where do these wars come from? We trace it back to Cain and Abel, but we can go back further than that. The god of this world, Satan, is a god of violence. Violence is his answer to many things. We can see this in Ezekiel 28, verse 14. Ezekiel 28, verse 14. God speaking to Lucifer says, "You are the anointed cherub who covers. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of fiery stones. You were perfect in the ways from the day you were created till iniquity was found in you. By the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence within. And you sinned. Therefore, I cast you out as a profane thing out of the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O covering cherub. From the midst of the fiery stones, your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor, and I cast you to the ground. I laid you before kings that they might gaze at you." Satan became filled with violence within. Satan's described as a murderer, a roaring lion seeking prey, and a dragon making war in heaven. And he's not done with his wars. We see what appears to be a parallel situation in Revelation 12, verse 7 through 9, if you want to turn over there. It describes an attempt by Satan once again to overthrow God shortly before Christ's return. Revelation 12, verse 7 through 9. "And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon. And the dragon and his angels fought, but they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him." Violence is a way of life for Satan. And as inhabitants of this world, it's become a way of life for man. Man has learned that way. Paul accurately described the human condition in the book of Isaiah, Isaiah 59, verse 7 and 8. He wrote, "Their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Wasting and destruction are in their paths. In the way of peace they have not known, and there is no justice in their ways. They have made themselves crooked paths. Whoever takes that way shall not know peace." Again, Paul quoted that, describing humankind. Their feet run to evil. They make haste to shed innocent blood. The world does not have peace. The world will never have peace as long as Satan is its leader, because the world does not understand peace. The world looks at peace sometimes as an absence of violence. But there's never been an absence of violence in the world. There's an absence of violence from country to country, from time to time. But even within that country, there's no absence of violence. But the world does not understand peace. And we can get a better understanding of that in 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 3. It says, "For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them, as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape." The world thinks peace and safety, not even realizing that we're all sitting on a ticking time bomb. A bomb that has been there since the beginning of time, and it's getting closer and closer to exploding, and it will never be defused until it explodes. But there is a change coming. And that's what we're here to picture, this change that's going to take place on this earth. There's a magnificent change coming that man, in his wildest dreams, can't even imagine. There's a new leadership coming. Leadership by a king who understands peace, who has the nickname of a Prince of Peace. Isaiah 9, verse 6, if you'll turn over there. Isaiah 9, verse 6 and 7 talks about that time when this world will be under a new leadership. It says, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder. And his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice. From that time forward, even forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. We're told there will be no end to his peace. Once God's government is set up and mankind begins to learn more and more about what peace is and how to bring it about, it will continue to increase and grow until the whole world is nothing but peaceful. Peace will increase continually throughout his reign. We have ways of ensuring peace right now. We keep peace on a big scale through destructive ways. Alfred Nobel, the founder of the Nobel Peace Prize and the inventor of dynamite, thought his destructive invention would lead to peace. He thought it would be so horrible that mankind would look at dynamite, see its destructive power, and never again go to war. Dynamite did not lead to world peace. After World War II, the United States and Russia had a similar thought of creating world peace. It's appropriately named MAD, and it stands for Mutually Assured Destruction. The thought is that if one country launches a nuclear strike against the other country, there's an automatic response that will take place, whether there's people left or not, an automatic response that will launch a second attack that will inflict just as much damage and destruction upon whoever did the first launch. Again, the idea was that world peace will be kept through destructive means. This is how the world maintains peace, at least from a nuclear strike. But the world still has not had peace. The United States and Russia has had many proxy wars where we've technically fought each other through another country. We've never had peace. Peace is not having the biggest, most destructive weapon. Peace is not scaring someone into not attacking you. Peace deals with the heart, with the thoughts of man. Peace is described very differently in the Bible. If you'll turn over to Micah 4, verses 1 through 3, we'll get an idea of what peace will look like in the future. Micah 4 and verse 1 says, "Now it came to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills. And people shall flow to it. Many nations shall come and say, 'Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths.'" That's the beginning of it right there. The people will want to learn God's ways and will want to walk in his paths. "For out of Zion the law will go forth, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." Verse 3, "And he will judge between many peoples, and rebuke strong nations afar off. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore." So we see a peace that's not kept by who has the biggest weapon. We see a peace that is so complete that nations won't even have weapons. No one will feel the need to man an army or to learn how to fight a war. All those destructive thoughts will go away. Swords into plowshares. Have you ever really considered what that is? There's a beautiful statue in front of the United Nations of a man who has a large sword and a hammer, and he's beating on it, and the other end is starting to take shape as a plow. It's a beautiful thought. But have you ever thought, what would that really look like? I mean, there's the actual literal part of taking a weapon and turning it into something productive. We could take a jet airplane and dismantle it, start refashioning the components that are there into plows and other farming equipment. But there's more to this verse than just repurposing military equipment. Think about the peace dividend. The United States F-35 Lightning II Joint Strike Fighter is estimated to be the most expensive weapons system ever created. This is based on projected lifetime cost of $1.5 trillion, not to mention the $76 billion that went into research and development. What a waste. What a waste of resources. What if we were to take just 10% of their R&D budget, 10% of their $76 billion, took some of their top scientists and top engineers, because that's where all the top scientists and top engineers go. They end up working for companies that develop some sort of weaponry system. What if we took just the top 10 scientists, top 10 engineers, and gave them 10% of that budget and said, make a better rotor tiller? What would that look like? That's what the kingdom will be like. There will be no more wasted resources. We use a lot of gold and platinum and silver and metals like that in our weapons because they make really nice contacts and they're very reliable. You know, there might be some theory behind a platinum toaster with gold contacts and silver heating elements that might make the best piece of toast you'll ever taste in your life. But we're not going to figure that out now because that's not where our research is going. There will be a peace dividend, and we will all benefit from it. In the kingdom, our cities will be safe. As I said, we're in the midst of seven battles or skirmishes or wars or whatever you want to call them around the globe right now. But because of where we are, we don't recognize it here so much. Unless you have someone involved in those battles, we don't even think about it. We go day to day without even thinking about our country being at war. But there are cities in this world where they know what war is. They experience it every day. We have huge amounts of refugees trying to get away from war, trying to go somewhere safe. But in God's kingdom, our cities will be safe. Zechariah 8, verses 1 through 5. Zechariah 8, verse 1. Again, the word of the Lord of hosts came, saying, thus says the Lord of hosts, I am zealous for Zion with great zeal. With great fervor I am zealous for her. Then says the Lord, I will return to Zion and dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. Jerusalem shall be called the city of truth, the mountains of the Lord of hosts, the holy mountain. Thus says the Lord of hosts, old men and old women shall again sit in the streets of Jerusalem, each one with his staff in his hand because of great age. The streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in its streets. Can you imagine Jerusalem having peace like that? Jerusalem has been a violent city for a long time. Old men and old women feeling safe enough to sit there and watch their grandchildren playing in the streets. Parents feeling safe enough to let their children go out and play in the streets. What a world that pictures. Can you imagine that in Jerusalem? Can you imagine that in Cairo? Can you imagine that in Chicago? Again, We don't recognize when we're in wars here sometimes, but we don't have peace. Our cities are just as violent as some of the cities around the world. It won't be like that in God's kingdom. It'll be a time when the most frail and the most vulnerable will be safe. What a wonderful time that will be. We're going to have so much peace that even the nature of animals are going to be changed. If you'll turn over to Isaiah 11, verse 6. Isaiah 11, verse 6 says, "The wolf shall also dwell with the lamb. The leopard shall lie down with the young goat, the calf and the young lion and the fatling together. And a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze. The young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play by the cobra's hole, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the viper's den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." It starts with the knowledge of the Lord. Now, we heard the other day how these verses apply to a change of government, and I appreciated a refreshing look at these verses, something I had never thought of before. But we do look at this also as a literal thing that will happen. The nature of animals will be changed. If not, generations of God's people are going to be disappointed because we want to play with our lions. We've been told this forever. We do believe this will be a literal changing of the animal's nature. And sometimes we think, how impossible is that? Could you imagine being out here taking a hike on these beautiful mountains, turning a corner and running into a bear? It would be quite scary, because as we heard earlier, bears will straight up kill you. From the mouths of babes, right? Could you imagine that, though, being out there and coming upon a bear? It would be quite scary. But in God's kingdom, you could run up and grab that bear and start wrestling with it. We think of that sometimes and think, how impossible is that that could happen? How impossible is it that I could play with a lion or a snake or swim with a shark? The fact is, I believe changing the nature of an animal will be easier than changing the nature of man. You see, animals fight and kill out of instinct. It's a survival mode for them. It's hate and revenge for men. It's going to be much harder to change the attitude of man than it will be for God to change the nature of animals. There is a change coming in God's kingdom, and we're all looking forward to it. If you remember the opening night movie that we had, and they asked people, what are you most looking forward to in God's kingdom? And some people said, I can't even put that into words. But there were a couple people, they just kind of exhaled and their shoulders dropped. And they said, peace. I'm looking forward to peace. Because this world does not have peace. So we're looking forward to that time. Peace between nations, peace between the animal world, peace between neighbors. But what about now? Do we have peace in our lives now? Are you at peace with your neighbor, with your family? We live in a world of conflict, and it will be a world of conflict until Christ returns. And in some ways, it's going to be an even bigger challenge for us to live in a world of peace. Let's turn over to Matthew 10, verse 34. Matthew 10, verse 34 says, "Do not think that I come to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies will be those of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. And he who finds his life will lose it, and he who loses his life for my sake will find it." Christ told his disciples, don't think I've come to fix all the problems right now. Don't think you're going to have this great peace in your life right now without working at it. Because the very way of life that Christ was telling his disciples and us that we need to live will put us at odds with many people. It will put us at odds with many people in our family sometimes. Many of you, I'm sure, have been called as the only ones in your family, and your family doesn't understand, and they don't like you telling them that what they're doing is wrong. When I grew up in the church, it was just my family. I didn't have the cousins and the aunts and the uncles, and there were times, especially around Christmas, when that was pointed out, not in a loving way. And I'm sure many of you have experienced that. Many of you may have, because of living this way of life, had a wedge driven between you and your mate. And Christ said that's the way it was going to be. If we were going to truly follow his way of life, we were going to be so different from the way the world goes that it would cause us problems. And a lot of those problems would come from those that we love the most. We have been called to experience peace in the midst of violence. And we must not deal with that conflict the same way the world does, because we're given tools. We have to develop the fruit of the Spirit, which is love, joy, peace. And I believe you will never have the peace if you don't start with the love and the joy. This is a spiritual concept that we must develop. Building peace in our life will take work. Turn over to Matthew 5 and verse 38, if you will. This is the kind of work it will take to develop peace in our life. Matthew 5, verse 38, "You have heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person, for whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other cheek to him also." A previous pastor in Dayton, Mr. Frank McCrady, used to explain this to us this way. If you walk through a door and someone punches you in the nose, but then they immediately start apologizing, saying they're sorry, they didn't really know what came over them, they don't know why they punched you in the nose, you're to forgive them. If you walk through that door a second time and that same person punches you in the nose again and then begins to apologize, saying they're sorry, they didn't know what came over them, you are to forgive that person. The third time, you don't walk through that door. We have to use wisdom. We have a part to play in having peace in our lives. We don't need to keep setting ourselves up to be knocked back down. That's not having peace. We need to learn peace because we're going to help teach peace. There will come a time when this world will be ready to learn what peace is, and we'll be able to help teach it. Isaiah 30, verse 20 and 21 says, "And though the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet your teachers will not be moved into a corner anymore, but your eyes shall see your teachers. Your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it, whenever you turn to the right hand or whether you turn to the left. We're going to be teachers. We're going to help teach the way of peace as a way of life. Micah 4:4 says, everyone will sit under his vine and under his fig tree. What a nice description. People just sitting on their property, under their fig trees. But what if while sitting under their fig tree, someone looks to their neighbor sitting under his fig tree and starts thinking, his fig tree is nicer than mine. That's the start of thoughts that need to be taken control. Someone like King David could show up and sit with him and explain they need to get those thoughts in control. You or I could show up and sit with that person and explain to them, you need to get those thoughts in control. And we can explain to them where those thoughts lead. And we can explain the idea of contentment. Somebody's fig tree is always going to look better than your fig tree if you allow it to. Our goal is found in Romans 12 and verse 18. Romans 12 and verse 18 says, if it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Live peaceably with all men. Sometimes that takes a sacrifice. We don't want to make sacrifices, do we? Our whole world is headed in a way of not wanting to make sacrifices. I want what's mine. I want what's due me. And we're getting to the point even where we're starting to think what's due us is what belongs to those who have worked hard for them and accomplished things in their lives, because it's not fair that they have something that we don't have. Sometimes, though, to have peace, you've got to make a sacrifice. Psalms 34 and verse 14 says to seek peace and pursue it. Seek peace. That is a strong action word. Sometimes my wife might ask me to grab something out of the pantry, and I will go and look for it. And I'll stand there in the door and say, I don't think we have any rice. She'll come over and move a box of oatmeal and say, we have rice. That's not seeking. Seeking would be to go through there and tear through there, moving everything, looking for something intently. That's the attitude we should have in seeking peace. Pursue it. Pursue is another highly active word. Chasing something down, deciding it's not going to get away from you. With every effort you have, you will chase it down until you catch it. Peace is showing that you care more about others than you do about winning an argument. I'd like for you to turn with me to Genesis chapter 26. Genesis chapter 26, we're going to start in verse 17. Verse 17, then Isaac departed from there and pitched his tent in the valley of Gerar and dwelt there. And Isaac dug again the wells of water which they had dug in the days of Abraham his father, for the Philistines had stopped them up after the death of Abraham. He called them by the names which his father had called them, and also Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found a well of running water there. But the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdmen, saying, "The water is ours." So he called the name of the well Esek, because they quarreled with him. He named this well the Well of Fighting. Isaac had a right. God had given him this land. Him and his men had just dug this well. Isaac had rights. Let's talk for a minute about digging a well. Today, if you want to dig a well, you call a truck. Well, you don't call a truck. You call a company that has a truck. And they come out, and they'll bore a hole down to the ground, 8 to 10 inches in diameter, and then they'll put a casing on it. In about 2 days, they can have a well dug. Wasn't like that in Isaac's time. The well had to be dug by hand, which meant the well had to be big enough for at least one person to be inside it, maybe two. And they would dig with shovels and picks. They would bust up rocks, dig out rocks. And after they got so deep, someone would have to be up on top hauling out the dirt and the rock. All the time they're building walls around inside the well of stone and cement and whatever it takes to secure the inside of the well so it doesn't fall back down on itself. It's a process that's estimated it took about 3 months to build a well. And wells were made out of quality because you didn't want to go through all that work just to have it collapse on itself. You remember the story of Christ and the woman at the well. She said her father Jacob had dug that well. That would make that well about 1,600 years old at that time. And it's believed it still exists today if you want to go over and visit that well. It's a quality built well. It took a lot of work to build a well. Let's look at Genesis 26, verse 21. Isaac did something amazing. He maintained peace between his men and the herdsmen of Gerar. He made a sacrifice. Genesis 26, verse 21, then they dug another well, and they quarreled over that one also, so he named it Sitna. Sitna means strife or hostility. Once again, this well that Isaac dug created strife. Again, Isaac's land, Isaac's work. It's been said that Isaac is an ordinary son of an extraordinary father and an ordinary father of extraordinary children. Isaac was an extraordinary peacemaker. Genesis 26, verse 22. Isaac realized these wells were not worth having one person die over. He was not willing to go to war to keep what was his. Genesis 26, verse 22, and he moved from there and dug another well that they did not quarrel over it, so he named it Rehoboth, which means open space, because he said, "For now the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land." What an incredible story of someone wanting peace in their life. As I said, he had every right to every one of those wells that was dug, but he simply moved on and decided it wasn't worth fighting over. It wasn't worth having this contention between him and the other herdsmen. So he became the bigger person and moved and dug another well. Two more times. To ensure peace. Isaac sought peace. He pursued it. That's the vigor we should have in seeking and pursuing peace. He sacrificed for it. And that is our goal. We look forward to the kingdom of God on earth when peace will be without end. It's something that we can't even imagine right now, but we know it's coming. If we want to look forward to a time when there's peace on earth, then we need to start having that peace in our lives today.